Well, go ahead and if you have not yet, you can download the our church app on your phone, and our connection card is in there, and you can fill that out. Say hi in there. If you'd prefer to do the cards that are in the lobby, we'd love for you to do that in the app or in the baskets out in the lobby. If you're giving this morning, it's an easy way to do that. And then our notes for this morning, the slides that are up on the screen the notes that we'll be talking through in our passage this morning, those are in the app as well. And so a great way to be able to stay connected. You can ask questions and you can text through there. And so really, really grateful for our app. And if you don't have that, I'd love for you to download that. So we're starting a new series this morning for the next couple of weeks. Your eyes, if you're looking at that graphic, your eyes are not going out. Well, maybe they are, but not because of the graphic. That bottom line there, it says meaning, and it's really fuzzy. And the search for meaning, for the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about the search for meaning from one of the most misunderstood books in the entire Bible. And that is the book of Ecclesiastes. Nobody seems really excited about getting into Ecclesiastes. And for good reason, right? What most people think, I mean, well, let me ask you. Just when somebody says, oh, we're going to be teaching through Ecclesiastes, or, you know, if you're reading through the Bible, it's like, uh-oh, we've made it to Ecclesiastes, right? What are some of the thoughts, if you've done this before, if you've read this or you've heard this before, what are some of your thoughts when you hear Ecclesiastes? Can you say it properly? That's the first thing, right? It's like, how hard of a name? Why couldn't they have shortened it? You know, just, yeah, it's such a hard name to say sometimes. Yeah, perfect. That's awesome. Good. What else? What else do you think of? What's that? From the birds, right? Yeah, from 1965, it was a chart topper, the birds. There's a time, turn, to everything there's a season, right? Almost directly right out of chapter 3, okay? That may be what a lot of people, that's the only thing about Ecclesiastes that some people know, right, is the birds. Good. What else? Life is meaningless. What an enjoyable book to find in the middle of the Bible. What an enjoyable, just life is me. Futility, right? Vanity. Oh, ecclesiastical, right? You know, so there's that the commonality, Greek word that means church or teacher or something. Yep. Church based Ecclesiastes. All right, fun fact. Just because I'm full of fun, you can count on me to come up with a fun fact. In our English Bible, so about 200 years or so before Jesus was born, the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, was translated into Greek in Egypt, because a lot of the Jewish people down there were losing their Hebrew and they wanted to have the Bible in their language. They were speaking Greek. And so we call that the Septuagint. And most of the names of the Old Testament books in our Bible come from the Greek, not the Hebrew. And so the Greek names. And so Ecclesiastes the Hebrew word is Kohelet. It's the teacher. And in fact, he calls himself in verse 1, the words of the teacher. Son of David, king over Jerusalem. And here we have Ecclesiastes. It's similar to ecclesiastical, church-based, right? The ecclesia is the body of believers, right? Good. I wasn't going to bring all that up, but since you asked, right? What else? Anything about Ecclesiastes that just sort of, as soon as you hear that word, anything that pops into your mind? That's pretty much the response that I expect, because it's not a book that we tend to spend a lot of time in, as Ethan pointed out, just the overwhelming, abundant joy of the futility and vanity of life just sort of makes us skip past it very quickly. You know, it's only 12 chapters, so if you're reading through the Bible, you're like, okay, I can do this in a week and just get past it and move on to something that's, seems a little bit better or whatever. I want to just do an introduction this morning, just because we're going to spend a couple of weeks in it. We're not going to spend tons of weeks in it, okay, because it really does get depressing in some points. We don't want to go all the way there. We need to keep a big view. And that's really the thing about Ecclesiastes. If you ever read it, it's actually been a joy for me to read this again several times over the last few weeks as I've been getting ready for this series, because I forget, because it isn't something that we read a lot, I forget what's in it sometimes. And as I've gone through it multiple times, I'm like, oh yeah, that's in there. Oh yeah, that's in. I remember. And if we read it, this is the danger. Sometimes if we read too slowly, we get sucked so far down into it, we miss the big picture, right? Of course, if we read too quickly, we miss some of the detail, and we're like, why was that even in there? So there is a balance. And just a couple of things as we sort of take a big picture overview. The book of Ecclesiastes was written by Solomon when he was king of Israel. Now, brief background, it doesn't say Solomon, it just says son of David, king in Jerusalem. Well, Solomon was the son of David, as the king in Jerusalem. And there is no other king, even in David's descendants, even in David's line, there was no other king who would be able to write the type of stuff that Solomon wrote in here, the accomplishments that he had. It has to be Solomon. Now, Solomon was king for 40 years, from about 20 years old to 60 years old. Died when he was 60 years old, which in today's, like, modern medicine and today's lifespans, that was actually pretty young, wasn't it? And so because of what he said he had tried and accomplished in this book, he was probably in his 40s or 50s, which those of us who are in our 40s or 50s, we are not old at all, right? That's very, very young. what we would consider midlife, he's writing his memoir. This is almost like his magnum opus, his final big thing that he's written as he's getting ready to wind down his life in his 40s or 50s. Okay, probably 50s. We're thinking midlife. And so if you read it, if you read too much of our culture into it, you're like, this guy is having a midlife crisis. Okay, and you almost think that just because of some of the, you know, what seems to be so depressing stuff in here. But that's not really what's happening. It's actually an end-life crisis, not a midlife crisis. No, what he's doing is he's going back and he's reviewing his life. And he's saying, I wonder, what is the meaning of life? Can I, as I'm winding down my time on this planet, much like 2 Peter, we saw a little while ago, as Peter was getting ready to die, here are the things that I need to make sure that you know. And Solomon was doing the same thing. As I'm winding down my life, here are the things that I want to make sure that I leave for those coming behind me. It does seem very depressing. And some of the key words, like futile, or some translations, vanity, right? On the earth or under the sun, chasing the wind. You know, you can't chase the wind. What does that really accomplish? It's a really windy day out here. What was that accomplish? Yeah, sometimes the wind was picking up yesterday, and we were cleaning some trash up in the parking lot out here. And, you know, you get that little piece of trash, and the wind just takes off, and you're chasing it down as fast as you can because you want to pick it up. And Nick was able to catch it. He caught that little piece of trash. I'm like, yeah, go Nick. And but if your whole life is like chasing the wind, man, that's can get really depressing. So we don't want to do that, and yet this is sort of what most people think of, maybe this is all we know about the book of Ecclesiastes, if anything at all. And so you might think, you know, he's, you know, doing a midlife crisis or an end-life crisis, or he needs to be on meds or something, but that's not actually the case, because if you dig back a little bit into his life, you find out that Solomon ruled over Israel during its golden age. In all of world history, there's only been one time when Israel, that tiny, tiny little country over there in the Middle East, there's only one time in all of world history that Israel was actually like the empire of the world. And it was under Solomon's reign. And it was it not even though the country itself, the nation was in a tiny little plot of land, Solomon, actually David, had subdued a lot of nations around him, and Solomon expanded that. And even though he wasn't the king over all these nations, it was a world empire where they were sending him taxes and tribute. He was, like some estimates say, that he was bringing in billions of dollars in today's money every year into the national economy of Israel at that time. Between GDP, between the taxes and the foreign trade, between his mining operations, he had gold mines and copper mines. There are some descriptions that say that gold and copper and some of these precious, we consider these some precious metals, were so plentiful in Israel at that time that you could just see them laying around on the street. That's how wealthy. So when you hear about, you know, the wisdom of Solomon or the wealth of Solomon, it wasn't just Solomon. It was the entire nation. It was everybody. They had more food than they knew what to do with. They had more minerals. They had more everything. The copper mines of Solomon are world-renowned, even in secular archaeology. There is evidence that, and I love this one. I really love this one. There is evidence that Solomon not only had a navy, which is really weird for Israel, you know, just right there on the Mediterranean, but his navy went everywhere on the planet. 2,500 years, I think, before Ferdinand Magellan. You know, the first person to circumnavigate the earth. Even though he didn't, he died and his crew finished, right? Like, thousands of years before Ferdinand Magellan even tried, Solomon's navy had stepped foot on every continent. There is evidence it's really cool, down in South America, high up in a mountain where you can barely even get anymore without a ton of technology and equipment, there's Hebrew inscribed on walls and caves. Ancient Hebrew. Where did that come from? See, there's evidence all over the... Solomon literally, I mean, he wasn't ruling the world, but he was like all over the world. He put his fingerprints on the entire planet. This is not a guy just, you know, depressed with a blog. Okay, this is not a guy who's holed up in his parents' basement just wondering, you know, what's the meaning of life. This is a guy who had seen everything, who had tried everything, and as he came down to the end of his life, he's like, I have to share what I learned. And it wasn't, by the way, it wasn't even the nation. I mean, there were things that Solomon himself, he accomplished. I love this description. It's in 1 Kings chapter 4. And I just really love this description. Here we go. Starting at verse 20, I just want to scroll through some of this stuff. The people of Judah and Israel were as innumerable as the sand on the seashore. They had plenty to eat and drink and were happy. Solomon ruled all the kingdoms from the Euphrates River to the land of the Philistines. So that would be modern-day Israel all the way into Iraq, modern-day Iraq. As far as the border of Egypt, so now we're going south as well. The kingdoms paid tribute as Solomon's subjects throughout his lifetime. Each day, Solomon's royal court consumed 30 cores of finely milled flour, 60 cores of cereal, 10 calves in the stall, 20 calves from the pasture. So 30 calves a day consumed by his court. I forgot to convert cores into, you know, whatever we eat today. Plus 100 sheep, not to mention rams, gazelles, deer, and birds. This was his court. This is not even the nation. This was just his inner circle, what they ate every day. His royal court was so large because he ruled all over from Tifsa to Gaza. Okay, he was at peace with all of his neighbors. All the people of Judah, and Israel had security from Dan, which is in the furthest north, to Beersheba, which is in the furthest south of Israel. Enjoyed the produce of their vines and fig trees throughout Solomon's lifetime. He had 4,000 stalls for his chariot horses, 12,000 horses. the district governors required supplies for King Solomon and all who ate in his royal palace. Each was responsible for 1 month in the year. Just so he had an organization. He's like, okay, your job is to feed us this month. Now, if this is what we eat every day, this month is a big acquisition, right? They brought the assigned location of his quota, you know, barley and straw for the horses and everything. But that's just the country. Look at what Solomon himself. Watch Solomon himself. Now, God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment. The breadth of his understanding was infinite as the sand on the seashore. Solomon was wiser than all the men of the east and all the sages of Egypt. And then there's a couple of names listed here which don't necessarily mean anything to us today because we don't have any records of them. But back then, it really mattered. Ethan the Ezrahite, or Haman, or Halcol, or Darda, the sons of Mahol. He was famous in all the neighboring nations. Now, check this out. If you thought you were productive last week. He composed 3,000 proverbs. Now, it's pretty well known that most of what we call the Book of Proverbs was probably written by Solomon. Okay, not all of it. There were some others that are listed in there. But there are not 3,000 in that book. Okay, what we have in Proverbs is not 3,000. So he kept writing. He had all these other things. In fact, we'll see some of them in Ecclesiastes. And 1,005 songs. So he was a poet. He was a lyricist, a musical artist, apparently. But he's also a scientist. He produced manuals on botany, describing every kind of plant from the cedars of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows on the wall. He produced manuals on biology, describing animals, birds, insects, fish. People from all the nations came to hear Solomon's display of wisdom. He had a lecture hall. And, of course, if he's describing these things, he has to go to their location. So he went on lecture tours, right? Had his book table set up there. And, you know, here's my, here's, you know, we're having a lecture on cedars today. Here's everything I've written about cedar trees. I mean, just all over the place. They came from all the kings of the earth who heard about his wisdom. I mean, this is not some depressed guy just sitting at home. Well-read, well-studied, well-taught, the whole thing. And by the way, this is not just, oh, God dumped all this information into his head. Right? God gave him a gift of wisdom, we're told, that exceeded what anybody else had, and then he used it to do something, right? You can be the smartest, you can be the wisest person in the world, and you can sit at home and accomplish nothing. Never write a proverb, never write a song, never write a book, never do all of this other stuff that he did, right? It wasn't because God just said, here, and just dumped it. He took what God gave him and he used it to the best of his ability. And I think that's a huge principle for us that even just doesn't really have anything to do with Ecclesiastes so much, but just a principle that he could have sat at home and done nothing. And instead, he became one of the, if not the greatest person who ever produced all of these accomplishments in his lifetime. And so as we come to the book of Ecclesiastes itself, with what seems to be such a depressing message, we have to understand that Solomon is not just saying, oh, life doesn't mean anything, without some kind of basis for that. He says, I've done it, I've tried it, and here is my conclusion. In fact, the book of Ecclesiastes is not just one funeral dirge after another. Okay, like it may sound like it's actually got several different aspects to it, like investigative reporting. He says, in fact, if we were to scroll through, I've highlighted some of these already, but I decided in chapter 1, verse 12, I decided to carefully and thoroughly examine. I concluded, I reflected, I concluded, I thought to myself. So I decided, I thought to myself, I thought deeply. We're into chapter 2. Yet when I reflected on everything I had accomplished, next I decided to consider. I realized, so I thought to myself, so, well, now we get into some of that depressing. So I loathed life. Okay, that really brings us more into philosophy than investigative journalism. So I loathed all the fruit of my effort. So I began to despair. I'm not saying there isn't depressing parts in here, but it's not the whole message, right? And so we've got all of this in here. He's like, I am going to look at this. I'm going to look very carefully. I have questions, and I want answers. And so he looked very carefully, and this is just the first couple of chapters I scrolled through very quickly. That's not even the whole thing. So there's investigative reporting, really. There's, of course, philosophy. I thought deeply about this. In this, it's not really a long book, 12 chapters, but in this book, we find, I just listed in my notes here, I just listed some deep thoughts about life, death, existence in general, thoughts about humans, animals, work, time, thoughts about marriage, financial investments, youth versus old age. All of this is in Ecclesiastes. Okay? There's a ton of stuff in here that if we just blow past it, we're going to miss. Lots of observations, and as we've seen, lots of conclusions. But there's also Proverbs and some wisdom sections in here as well. They're not necessarily observations. They're just like, here's a truth. It's just the way it is. Here's something for you to think about. So maybe you put it under philosophy a little bit. We already mentioned Ecclesiastes chapter 3, right? There's a time for everything, and you know, the birds put that to music. Here are a couple of my favorite proverbs that we still use today, and they come right out of Ecclesiastes. In chapter 4, two are better than one, right? Two heads are better than one. Sometimes we say it that way. Comes right out of Ecclesiastes 4. Chapter 10, there's a fly in the ointment. That's not one that we necessarily say a lot, but you've heard that one before. Fly in the ointment, Ecclesiastes 10. Also in chapter 10 is a little birdie told me. You know, that was in Ecclesiastes, right out of there. And then in chapter 11, depending on your translation, cast your bread upon the waters. You've heard that phrase where you split your investment. This one is not in Ecclesiastes, but the same context is, our concept is, don't put all your eggs in one basket, right? Spread it out, okay? And in chapter 11, he says, cast your bread or your grain upon the waters, split it out into 7 or 8 investments so that you don't lose your whole thing. This is Ecclesiastes, okay? Not some dry, old, boring, dark, depressing book. There's a ton of wisdom in here. There's a lot of thought that was put into this, and so, just as we're introducing this, we'll spend a couple of weeks here. But just as we're introducing this, what are some of the things in chapters 1 and 2 that he said, you know what, I'd like to investigate. I'd like to investigate. So, where did he try to find meaning? I'll just give you four big ones here in chapters 1 and 2. Verse 17, so I decided to discern the benefit of wisdom and knowledge over foolish behavior and ideas. What is the point in trying to be smart? What is the point in trying to be wise over being foolish? Sometimes it seems like foolish people have more fun, right? You know, there's that saying, again, it's not Ecclesiastes, but ignorance is bliss, right? We all know that one. That's what he was trying to tease out. Is ignorance really bliss? Do fools, do ignorant people really have more fun? Is that a better way to go? It's called the curse of knowledge. Once you know something, you know, unless you get sick or you have a memory loss or something, you can't unknow it, right? And so... Now that you know it and you can't unknow it, that colors everything that you see, it colors everything you think, it colors everything you do. And sometimes you know something that you wish you didn't know, right? And you look at people who are blissfully unaware of whatever that is and say, I wish I could go back there. I wish I didn't know that, right? And so he said, let me tease this out. God has given me all this wisdom. I've found all this knowledge in my studies and everything. I wonder if it's actually better or if it really is more blissful to be ignorant. He said, I decided to try that out. Down in chapter 2, verse 1, here's another one. He said, I thought to myself, come now, I will try self-indulgent pleasure to see if it's worthwhile. And if you know anything about Solomon's personal life, he indeed tried self-indulgent pleasure. He tried everything, and he'll talk about possessions here in just a second. And what he concluded here was, he said, I found that it is also futile or vanity. I said of partying, it's folly. Of self-indulgent pleasure, it accomplishes nothing. This is obviously a task-driven person, right? Looking for that checklist I thought deeply about the effects of indulging myself with wine. All the while, my mind was guiding me with wisdom, right? He's like, I'm not going to take it too far. And the effects of behaving foolishly so that I might discover what's profitable. Because what is profitable for people to do on earth during the few days of their lives. He said, but then I also went to possessions, all right? I found out that self-indulgence didn't do anything. I'm also going to look at possessions. Verse 4, I increased my possessions. I built houses, planted vineyards, designed royal gardens and parks, planted all kinds of fruit trees, constructed pools for myself and to irrigate the grove of flourishing trees, male and female slaves, those born into his house, livestock, herds, flocks, more than any of my predecessors in Jerusalem. It says I owned more stuff than anybody else. I amassed silver and gold, verse 8. Valuable treasures taken from kingdoms and provinces, male singers, female singers. He had his own orchestra, his own symphony, his own choir. Everything that gives man sensual delight, a harem of beautiful concubines, 700 to be, right around there. According to 1 Kings chapter 11, over his reign, he had 300 wives and 700 concubines. And a concubine was basically somebody who was traded for political favor. She was a wife from a wife that he took from another country, and for political clout, he brought her into his harem, and basically she had not the same level of rights as a wife, but she was protected. So he had sexual rights with her, 1,000 women, and if she had children, then they would still be sons of the king and sons and daughters of the king. But she had no rights as a wife, no rights. She'd never be a queen, never have anything. She was just protected in the harem as a political trade. 300 wives, 700 concubines. He said, I tried it all. So I was far wealthier than all my predecessors, yet I maintained my objectivity. We might question that part. I did not restrain myself, verse 10, from getting whatever I wanted. I did not deny myself anything that would bring me pleasure. So all my accomplishments gave me great joy, for this was my reward for all my effort. And what was his conclusion? Yet when I had reflected on everything I accomplished, on all the effort I had expended to accomplish it, I concluded all these achievements and possessions are ultimately profitless, like chasing the wind. There is nothing gained from them on earth. So wisdom and philosophy, knowledge, trying to live right, he didn't find any benefit. Self-indulgent pleasure, partying, anything he wanted, didn't find any benefit. Accumulating literally everything on the earth that he wanted didn't give him what he was looking for. Didn't find that fuzzy meaning, never came into sharp focus through those things. So, actually, according to chapter 2, verse 12, he said, so I'm going to try wisdom and philosophy again. So I did, part two, you know, let's try this again. Next, I decided to consider wisdom as well as foolish behavior and ideas. For what more can the king's successor do than what the king's already done? Right? What else is left? Right? Somebody's coming behind me. And he came to some of these conclusions. But ultimately, again, on their own, they did not bring him the fulfillment and the meaning and the purpose that he was looking for. And this is exactly why this ancient, dusty, dark, gloomy, seemingly depressing book is so relevant in the 21st century. Because what Solomon just said, what we read through so very quickly, just in these first two chapters, is exactly what we see in people's lives today, right? People are searching for meaning everywhere. Everywhere. And they always seem to come up a little short. Always. They can't find it. They know there should be meaning in life. After World War II, a psychologist by the name of Viktor Frankl wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning. I don't know if you've read it. He was a Jewish psychologist, and he had studied under Freud and some of these other guys, and he lost most of his family in the Holocaust. He's a European Jew, lost most of his family in concentration camps. He was in a concentration camp for a short while, and when he came out, and he started writing about his time in the concentration camp, trying to figure out what could this possibly mean. Why could this? And then he went into the psychological aspect, and he came up with basically it was a brand new theory at that time. And today it's sort of commonplace. We hear it in a lot of places, in a lot of lectures and podcasts and TED Talks and all of the different things that people talk. We hear this, the what really started as an outgrowth of Viktor Frankl's time in the concentration camp, and as he was going through trying to find what could that possibly, how could that help him or whatever, his conclusion was, if a person can find meaning to life, then they can find life. And the name of the book is Man's Search for Meaning. And he created a whole new, I mean, this seems like commonplace to us, but if you take it back 80 years, it wasn't commonplace. 70 years, it wasn't commonplace. They weren't searching for meaning. Okay? What he did, without knowing it, is he came to the exact same conclusion that Solomon did 3,000 years ago. Said there has to be meaning, because if there's not meaning, if there's not purpose, if there's not a destination or a goal, if there's not something I'm shooting for, I'm just running around trying to chase the wind. That's all life is just chasing the wind. There's got to be something there. And so here's his first major conclusion. And it's in chapter 2, verses 24 to 26. Verse 24 is our key verse this morning, actually, as well, if you want to memorize one. Here's his conclusion. After he's tried all these things, or in these first couple of chapters, here's his first major conclusion. There's nothing better for people than to eat and drink and to find enjoyment in their work. Didn't he just say that that doesn't actually give meaning? Didn't he just say that doing all that doesn't actually help? But notice, because in verse 24, we find the very first instance of something that is not connected to, depending on your translation, under the sun or on earth. And that is, I also perceive that this ability to find enjoyment comes from God. This is the first mention of God in the book. You have to go through two chapters, and I think that is significant. This is the turning point. You have to go through two chapters of philosophy and wisdom and searching and chasing and futility and vanity and all this stuff, chasing the wind, until he finally says, hold on a second, there is something that has not yet been taken into consideration. And that is that it's not just about here on earth, there is actually something bigger. There's something greater. Now, Solomon was not exactly the best spiritual role model for anybody, really. Okay? As he was marrying these women from these other countries and making these political alliances, one of his major failures is that for every woman that he brought home, he created a shrine to her home gods. Let her worship the way she wanted to worship. And he never turned away from the true God as like the greatest of gods, but he turned away from the true God as the only true God. And as he was building these shrines and these temples for all of his wives and concubines, he started raising the level of them in his own mind. I'm sure it was very slow at first. He did not intend to. He had built this great temple for the true God there in Jerusalem. Solomon's temple is one of the probably the wonder of that part of the ancient world at the time. Incomparable. Nothing could compare to that thing. But the more of these shrines he built, and the more of these gods he allowed into Israel, and the more of these women who brought that philosophy and that theology and religion with them, the higher these came in his sight and the lower the true God came, until God was not the true God, the only one worth worshiping, the only one worth living. He was just the greatest of all of the rest. And so true God, Jehovah, was just a little bit higher than all of these other ones in Israel under Solomon's reign. That's not cool. That's not good. But here, at least he said there is something, someone higher. He said that he perceived that this ability to find enjoyment in eating and drinking and work and whatever comes from God. For no one can eat and drink or experience joy apart from him. For to the one who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of amassing wealth only to give it to the one who pleases God. And so this task of the wicked is futile, like chasing the wind. Now, if we stopped there, if we didn't have the rest of the Bible, we could really get into some bad karma theology off of this one conclusion, right? Basically, what he says, if we don't have anything, you know, just throw away the rest of the Bible, if it landed here, then, according to verse 26, my job in this life is to please God so that I can have wisdom and knowledge and joy and get the wealth of the one who doesn't please God. Now, there are some religions that believe that. There's some religions that teach that, that if you just, you know, make sure that God is happy, he will give you anything that you want. Right? And that's what it sounds like. This is a good reason we don't get so dug down into just one tiny little passage and forget everything else. We have to stay connected. The rest of the Bible, including in the rest of the Old Testament, but especially in the New Testament, tells us that God, that this is not the only gift of God. Enjoyment in this life is not the only gift of God, right? We can have real life, and of course that comes through a relationship with God through Jesus alone. And that brings us to the last thing in Ecclesiastes that I want to point out this morning, and that's in chapter 3. Solomon, the same guy who wrote all this stuff, Solomon also wrote, we're going to skip the turn for a minute. Solomon also wrote, God has made everything fit beautifully in its appropriate time. He has also placed ignorance in the human heart so that people cannot discover what God has ordained from the beginning to the end of their lives. Now, that word translated ignorance there, in some translations it says God has placed eternity or darkness in their hearts. It's a hard word to translate, especially given the context. It makes it a little bit weird. But if you think of ignorance or eternity or darkness or maybe even the future, bring that all together, the concept is that God has placed in each person a void. God has placed in each person a kind of void, a kind of darkness, a kind of something that we cannot quite fit, we cannot fill, we cannot figure out exactly how to make that void go away. It's an emptiness that God intentionally put in there. And because God put it in there, God is the only one who can solve it. And 3,000 years ago, Solomon said, God is the one who did that. And as he works his way through, by the time we get to chapter 12, when he gives his big conclusion, it all comes back to God. We just have the hint of it here in chapter 2. But by the time we get to chapter 12, when he finally sums everything up, it all comes back to God. And this is the reason right here in chapter 3. Because God gave us a void, God gave us a hole, an emptiness, call it eternity, call it darkness, call it ignorance, call it something, that he does not allow anything else. And Solomon says, I've tried it all. I've tried it all. And the void never got full. God put it there. Only God can fill it. And that's where the rest of the Bible comes in. Because God said, you can't come up to my level. So I'm going to come down to yours. Right? Now I know it's not Thanksgiving yet, so we're not allowed to talk about Christmas. But that's what Christmas is about. God coming down to our level because we can't come up to his. God coming to us because every time we tried, we failed. In fact, Paul's term for that was, we fell short. Every time we tried to get to God's level, we keep coming up short. And so God said, I'll come down to your level, so that I can bring you up in the way that only I can. And God says that's through a relationship with Christ. That's why we do what we do. That's why we believe. That's why we teach what we do here at Oak Tree. That's why when we study the scriptures, we see we can come to Ecclesiastes and not find just some old, depressing, dark, gloomy book. There is hope in this book. And honestly, we didn't really have to look hard to find it. It was there. But a lot of it is because if you know Christ as your Savior, you have a different worldview, right? You have a different way of seeing things. The majority of this world is still living in chapters 1 and 2. What's the meaning of life? What's the purpose of life? Maybe I can just, you know, appease the gods or the universe out there so that at least I can have some kind of peace as I navigate through this. I don't know what the afterlife looks like, even if there is one. All they're doing is they are trying to fill that hole that God put there. We've got the answer. We've got the answer. And that's why we need to make sure we are sharing it with them. And so, one question as we finish up this morning, and that is, have you discovered the meaning of life that God has laid out for us, for you? For some people, because everybody has to do this, for some people that is coming to God for the very first time to know him and to love him through Jesus' death and resurrection. Because he's the only one. We keep coming up short, right? He's the only one that can take us all the way to God. The only one. Those are God's terms and conditions. Everything else falls short or makes us fall short. But even after we know Jesus as Savior, even after we've come into a relationship with God, we can spend our entire life just spinning around hoping that God is happy with us and not knowing what to do. That's why we talk about the path. That's why we talk about growing spiritually. That's why we talk about serving him, actually doing these things. Solomon accomplished so much. And yet still, even at the end of his life, he's like, that stuff did not actually bring the joy that I was looking for. It was good, but it didn't bring him closer to God. That's what we're looking for. And so we've got to come to God for the very first time, and then we need to keep growing in that. And that's the only way we find meaning. That's the only way that meaning then can come into focus. For everybody else, meaning, purpose stays fuzzy, right? Just spinning our wheels, chasing the wind, whatever terminology you like to use. We have it. We know what it is. And of all places, we can find it in the book of Ecclesiastes. How cool is that? It's in there. We'll spend a few more weeks there looking at some of these a little bit deeper. But I want you to see that. I want you to be excited about the book of Ecclesiastes. You never know, you'd never think that you could do that. But I want you to be excited about it because there's a lot of good stuff in here. Where are you in your relationship with God? That's really what the question is. Whether you've come to Him for the very first time, or maybe it's time to say, you know what? I've been spinning that hamster wheel for a long, long time, and it's time for me to get off the wheel and to come back, because You're the only one, God, who can give me what I'm looking for.